This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. When you find the person you want to marry, many of us hope our family will accept our future spouse wholeheartedly. Typically, we're less interested in what other people think, especially strangers. Today, Where We Live, we look back at a time in our nation's history when someone's opinion was the least of our worries. In 1958, more than a dozen states banned marriages between people of different races. Coming up, we'll learn more about the Lovings, an interracial couple who challenged Virginia's law that made it illegal for them to marry. Their fight led to a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1967. And later, we'll ask interracial couples in Connecticut about their lives and whether their marriages have been accepted within their families and within their communities. And we'll find out how the Loving v. Virginia decision years later impacted the marriage equality movement for same-sex couples. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org. As always, find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining me by the phone right now is David Yalov, professor and department head of political science at the University of Connecticut. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the Lovings. Who were they?
Well, Richard Loving and Mildred, formerly Jeter Loving, they met in the late 1950s. Mildred got pregnant, and the two of them decided to get married, but Richard Loving was white by the definition of the Racial Integrity Act of 1924 in Virginia. Mildred was African American, black, and thus under the laws of Virginia, they could not marry. So they ran to nearby Washington, D.C., got married, and then attempted to come back and live their lives.
You mentioned Virginia. So there were, more than a dozen states that had similar laws, these anti-miscegenation laws, meaning that people of different races couldn't mix.
Yeah, that's correct. In 1948, just a decade earlier, as many as 29 of the 48 states had these miscegenation laws that banned interracial marriage. And really, it didn't. They weren't eliminated over the next two decades to any degree, as you point out. As many as 16 or 17 states still had those laws on the books and enforced in the 1960s.
And how common were relationships, interracial marriages, rather, at the time when Mildred and Richard met?
Well, they weren't that common. Now, and that might explain why all of the efforts of groups like the NAACP and very often the ACLU was more focused on the parallel track of trying to desegregate the schools. Interracial marriage wasn't that common, but, you know, whether it was not common because of these laws, which made it illegal, or it was just simply not something that people were that interested in, as late as 1958, 94%, and according to a Gallup poll, actually continued to oppose interracial marriage. So it wasn't the kind of thing that was kind of sweeping the nation to make this change so early.
And if we look at that era, you know, with whites who were in power, I'm curious, among black communities, what did they think of these types of relationships?
Well, there was a mix even of opinion within black communities. I think there was a sense, as there is in some communities, even as late as today, that it may not be the greatest thing to have interracial marriage. You know, it obviously dates back to pre-Civil War days, and you know, the sexual assault of plantation owners that often led to children of mixed couples, obviously not married at that time. And so there was mixed feelings then, but I think what was not mixed, at least in the African American and black communities, was that it should be allowed. Whether it should be encouraged is a different issue. Nobody felt it should be prohibited. And I think that's a really, really important point, because the laws that actually banned interracial marriage, especially that 1924 law, they included justifications based on the superiority of the white race and the need to avoid inbreeding and mongrelization. So even in those communities that weren't sure they wanted to encourage it, they did not want it to be illegal.
I'm speaking with David Yalov, professor and department head of political science at UConn. Today we're talking about the Loving v. Virginia. This is the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1967 that banned states from saying that people of different races couldn't marry. Mildred Jeter and Richard Loving were a Virginia couple. Mildred was black, Richard was white. They fell in love, they wanted to marry. And as we heard, David, they went ahead and did so in D.C. When they came back to Virginia, they were arrested. And what was the penalty? So they did they plead guilty? What was the outcome there?
They did ultimately plead guilty. There wasn't a verdict from a judge. So they fought it, obviously, initially, but the law was very much against them. And the actual penalty, very controversial, was a form of banishment. It said that they had to leave the state of Virginia. Now, what's interesting is normally banishment says you can't come back. This penalty said they couldn't come back for a period of 25 to 30 years together, but they were able to come back separately, which is not exactly the way we think of banishment as a crime. You are each allowed to come separately. What you can't do is come together.
And again, this is 50 years since that U.S. Supreme Court decision, so they continued to fight that banishment from their home state of Virginia. This case is part of a movie that was released late last year. But in 2007, NPR spoke with one of the attorneys who represented the Lovings. His name was Bernard Cohen. And here he is talking about Mildred and Richard, the plaintiffs that he represented.
They were very simple people who were not interested in winning any civil rights principle. They just were in love with one another and wanted the right to live together as husband and wife in Virginia without interference from officialdom. When I told Richard that this case was in all likelihood going to go to the Supreme Court of the United States, he became wide-eyed and his jaw dropped.
And it did go before the Supreme Court. What was this decision? Tell us more about it, David.
Well, it was a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court, and it was rooted in the fundamental appreciation for the right of marriage. And that's a pretty important point, because many of the battles over equal protection at that time were based on the justification or the fight that you're treating the two races, people from the different races, differently, and thus that's the form of discrimination. The defense that was provided very often by states, the 16 or 17 states that still had them on the books, their basic defense was, forget the reasons why we passed this. Ultimately, it treats the two races the same. It says you're not allowed to marry outside of your race. And I think what the U.S. Supreme Court did unanimously was build on other decisions that had swept away anti-cohabitation laws and said, fundamentally, the right to marriage is so important and so critical an aspect of citizenship that to deny it on this kind of basis would be unconstitutional. And so that's how they did it.
And what was the response from these 16 states? Obviously, they couldn't enforce this ban anymore. I think most of these states were in the South. I mean, any resistance when that decision came down?
There was some resistance. We know about the resistance in Alabama. And the reason we know about the resistance in Alabama is because the Nixon administration in 1970, not normally viewed as on the cutting edge of civil rights enforcement, but they actually had to send officials down to help enforce the decree because Alabama was ignoring the Loving versus Virginia decision. And so they had to make sure and help. They sided with the couples that were seeking to enforce that particular Supreme Court decision. We haven't had anything like that since then, but I can tell you as late as 2000, Alabama, for example, had that law still technically on the books. They didn't actually take it off the books until recently, 2000.
And how did this decision years later impact the fight among same-sex couples for marriage equality for them as well?
Well, I think what it did, if you look at the Loving versus Virginia decision and the way that it trumpeted this notion of a fundamental right to marry, a lot of that language from Chief Justice Earl Warren's opinion for the unanimous court, there are echoes of it in Justice Kennedy's majority opinion in the recent Obergefell decision recognizing same-sex marriage as a right. The notion of marriage being a basic civil right of man, fundamental to our very existence and survival, those were Chief Justice Warren's words, that very much was an echo in the battle over same-sex marriage at the Supreme Court so many years later.
We're talking about this couple, Mildred and Richard Loving. Before the movie, do you think people knew about this case, Dave? David or knew about this this fight that this couple waged?
You know, I don't think so. I think this is not a decision that necessarily echoes so many years later. I think we look back at it and we don't think of interracial marriage and the issues surrounding miscegenation laws as a 20th century issue. We kind of push it back to Jim Crow days. But the truth is, this is a recent time. I was alive when this decision was handed down. And the recognition that this is not that long ago, the same-sex marriage battle, I think, brought this decision back because there really was a feeling by many litigators that it would be tough, difficult to distinguish between the two.
And we know today that the importance of our civil rights is still being debated. At the time that we're doing this show, there have been reports that the Trump administration is planning to reduce funding for the Civil Rights Division within the federal government. You know, what's the impact when that kind of announcement comes out?
Well, the truth is the aspects of enforcement, particularly whether the enforcement of certain laws is aggressive or is not aggressive, that is very much something that changes from administration to administration. Justice Department lawyers have told us that you can actually see a change in tone, let's say, from the Clinton administration to the George W. Bush administration, then to the Obama administration. So it can't be too surprising. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump said that he opposed the Obama administration's steps to revitalize fair housing enforcement, for example. And hate crime enforcement was something that a lot of money was poured into during the Obama administration. That is probably something that, while the Justice Department is not going to end hate crime enforcement, the issue is going to be resources and the issue is going to be the aggressiveness of the enforcement, and that is going to change significantly.
I've been speaking with David Yaloff, professor and department head of political science at UConn. He also specializes in constitutional law, judicial politics, and executive branch politics. David, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've heard about the Lovings who fought 50 years ago for the right to marry. Coming up, we'll talk with Connecticut residents who are in interracial marriages. Now, more people have married outside their race or ethnicity over the last 30 years. Does that mean we're becoming a more tolerant society? Join the conversation. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Talking about race is complicated, and it's a topic that deserves further discussion on future shows. Today, we're focusing in on interracial marriages. This year marks 50 years since the nation's highest court ruled it's unconstitutional for states to ban people of different races from marrying. And late last year, a film about their life, this interracial couple from Virginia, Mildred and Richard Loving, was released. That movie is called Loving. Here's a clip from the film. It portrays one of the plaintiff lawyers, Bernard Cohen, talking to Richard Loving about the case right before it was heard before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Is there anything you'd like me to say to them? And by them, I mean the Supreme Court justices of the United States?
Yeah. And tell the judge. Tell the judge I love my wife.
That's a clip from the movie Loving, released late last year. Now, how common are these marriages? Now, demographers have studied data about intermarriages, or marriages between a Hispanic and non-Hispanic person, or marriages between different racial groups, interracial, including whites, blacks, Asians, Native Americans, and mixed-race individuals. The Pew Research Center says intermarriage has become more popular in a 30-year period. About 15% of all new marriages in the U.S. in 2010 were between spouses of a different race or ethnicity, compared to 1980, when only 6% of interracial marriages were around. Now, our next guests are in an interracial marriage, and they live in Cromwell. I want to welcome to our studio today Shannon and Rahsaan Yearwood. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'll start with you, Shannon. You're not from Connecticut. Tell me about your upbringing outside of the blue state of Connecticut.
Sure. Well, I am from the Midwest, from Minnesota, and it's a great state. It's very progressive. Rahsaan and I actually met in college in Minnesota much longer ago than I will admit, and we have really had a great experience both in Minnesota and then coming to Connecticut, but we had a short intermission in Chicago too, They're both really great. They're all really great places to live.
Is that how you remember the story, Rahsaan?
Yeah, I mean, we were in college together, and I'm from New York City and live in Connecticut now. But yeah, we go back, and actually, if you think back 20-plus years, I ended up moving Shannon onto campus as an obligation of all the football players at college at the time.
And so you were friends, and then years later, you reconnected.
Yes, we were really, really very good friends for about 15 years before we even tried dating. And so we had reconnected at one of our good friends' weddings, and they're actually in an interracial marriage as well. And so we had really met up there and decided we would try this whole dating thing. Rahsaan had lived in Connecticut at that point. I was in Chicago. I had a lot of pets. He had a lot of children, and we thought it would be easier for me to relocate all of our furry children. And now we are one big, very big, happy family and have 5 kids that we are very proud of and very just love so much.
So a blended family living in Cromwell, Connecticut. Shannon's white. Rahsaan is black. What was the reaction within your family when you started dating?
Yeah, my family really was very accepting. It was, you know, I think they just... We have a really progressive family. My brother is gay, and I think my being in an interracial relationship was kind of par for the course for where we were going. And we didn't experience any issues. My mom absolutely adores her son-in-law and all of the many kids that we have. So, you know, we've been really blessed, and I am so blessed too. I have the best in-laws anybody could ever have, and it was fully welcomed into the family within about a second of meeting everybody. So they're all in New York, and we love going down there. It's been really great.
And Rahsaan?
Yeah, very similar. I mean, growing up in New York City, there's just so much diversity. My older brother is gay. My older sister is gay. So for my family, the idea of you loving and dating whoever you want to was always something that was very available to us. So by the time Shannon and I got together and began dating, you know, the diversity of relationships in the household had already blossomed as such that the idea of, you know, marrying a white woman was no more abstract than the idea if my sister decided to marry just another woman or my brother to marry another male. It was just kind of an accepted, you know, whoever you love, and it's up to you to make sure that relationship is, you know, surrounded by love and happiness.
So you grew up in a black community in New York, but you went to a predominantly white school?
Yeah, I grew up in Harlem on 147th Street in St. Nick. Hey, guys out there. But, you know, my whole life, my parents highly valued education, so I ended up going to Bank Street College for Children, and that was a private school where, you know, Robert De Niro's kids were there, you know, Bill Cosby's kids were there, so it was a very progressive kind of private school where we even called teachers by first names. We studied alternative history. I didn't take my first American history class until high school because we were studying, you know, the Native Americans and the Iroquois in upstate New York. Then I went on to Riverdale Country Day School and then Trevor Day. So I went to private school my whole life where there was probably, you know, 3 to 5% African-American students in these schools. And so my interacting with white people and dating white women, it started much earlier on in my life than college. And again, part of that's being in New York City, which is super progressive. And the other piece is just because you end up going to these schools that are predominantly white, affluent schools in New York.
Now, if you were living in a southern state, do you feel like your relationship and people's response to you would be similar?
I'm optimistic that, you know, as a 41-year-old person that's lived in a number of different cities, that the world in general is more progressive now than it was, you know, 30 years ago. I think that even in Connecticut or in New York, there are still times you're going to get people looking at you. But I think that's par for the course. I think that's the same anytime people see something that's different, they will tend to look more than not look just because it's different. But I've never had anyone approach me or say anything to me. We've traveled down to Tennessee through Kentucky and Virginia and never had any, you know, issues down there. But I think certainly if we were to go into like rural Alabama or Mississippi, we may get more looks than we get in Cromwell, Connecticut.
Shannon, what do you think?
I also want to go back a little bit to the family question. You know, when Rahsaan and I started dating and really getting bring our relationship to that level. My father had actually been gone for several years, and he was somebody who was born in 1913. And I do, he really was very progressive, and he really fought very hard on behalf of people's rights as an attorney in Minnesota. And I do think that it would have been a little bit different, because even though he was very progressive and very understanding, I think it would have been a little bit difficult for him at first because of the generation he was born in. So when I was reflecting on the family situation, you know, I was really thinking of more my mom, who in this day and age, it's really, she's really, I think, become a lot more open-minded and a lot more accepting of what her kids do. And plus, we're not in college anymore, so I think she's learned there's just so many lessons that go so far. So I do, you know, I haven't spent too much time in a lot of states that are in the South. I do love Kentucky, but we haven't been there together. But I do, you know, coming from the North and coming from these really progressive states, just hearing of the politics and everything that I've been exposed to, I do wonder if it would be a lot more difficult for us than it has been here.
And I bring up the response to you because even though we are in the Northeast in a progressive state like Connecticut, isolated incidents do happen. You know, just earlier this year, there was a story out of Stamford, Connecticut. An interracial couple found the N-word spray painted on their garage. And that couple, when interviewed, said they felt they were targeted because they were an interracial couple. So those incidents do happen. And in that sense, you know, how do we respond?
Mm-hmm. Well, that, you know, I think Rasan's very familiar with my pestering him at home, but I worry a lot about our kids. I think that we live in a great community, but I do think that they are going to have a little bit of a harder time. They're going to have to work a little bit harder because they're Black, and I don't think that that's fair, but I do think that that is what's going to happen. You know, they're pretty sheltered now, so I think when they move out of Cromwell, they'll probably be exposed to more difficulties than they've had, and I worry a lot about, are we preparing them for that? How do we prepare them for that? How do we not scare the heck out of them while we're preparing them for that? And really, by the time that they're going into college and going into their adult lives, hopefully the world will continue to progress in a positive way. I have some fears with how it's turned lately, but I'm eternally optimistic that we'll get to the other side of this and continue progress. So,
this is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about interracial marriages because this year marks 50 years since a landmark Supreme Court decision, Loving v. Virginia. This was a Virginia couple. She was white. He was Black. I'm sorry. She was Black. He was white. They married. Virginia had laws banning interracial marriage. They were banned from Virginia, told to live outside of the state. They fought for the right to marry, and the Supreme Court agreed with them unanimously in 1967. These days, we do see a lot more couples, interracial couples, interracial marriages. What does that mean? Have you ever been in an interracial relationship? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Are you a parent who your child has brought someone home that they're in a relationship with that's of a different race? How did you respond? What were some of your concerns? Maybe you don't have any. We'd like to hear from you, 860-275-7266. I wanted to find a little bit out more about Rasan in terms of, you know, your blended family. Shannon had mentioned just, you know, wondering like how your kids will navigate race as they grow older. I mean, what are some of your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's it's an interesting question, kind of interwoven into a lot of different questions. Like she said, I mean, I think the kids' idea of race is significantly different than mine growing up because of where I grew up, because times were different. I mean, New York City, I grew up in, you know, I was born in the 70s, grew up really in the 80s. And for anyone that lived in a major urban environment, predominantly in particular in a Black community, when you had crack cocaine kind of running through and there was a lot of police issues that were kind of built off what happened in the 60s and the 70s and segregation and everything else. So I think my kids' understanding of race is significantly different than mine because, again, they live in a community that's predominantly white. They don't feel the racial issues. I'm not sure how aware they are of everything going on around them. And so I think that, you know, we need to raise them to be aware of the realities of the world. But, you know, it's certainly possible that they can go through their lives and never be called a name or never have to, have a word painted on the garage. And we're certainly hopeful for that. But if that does happen, I'd like to think that they'll be prepared to handle it, you know, as responsible citizens and engage in the appropriate manners.
I think there's also this perception out there that if you're in a blended family or you may be in an interracial relationship that, you know, there's no prejudice, we have no biases, and we know that's not true. We're all human. But I am curious in terms of when you're, like, the idea of talking about it with your child. You know, part of the reason we're doing the show again is because of this news peg to this Supreme Court decision. But I'm also in an interracial marriage, and I have two children, two biracial children. One has a skin tone that's lighter than mine, but a little brown. And my daughter has the same skin tone as my husband. And so I've always wondered, you know, when do I start talking about race to my children? And the first time I had to do it was this past Martin Luther King Day, when my son came home. He's six and asked how Martin Luther King was killed. So that was an eye-opening moment for me. This was the time. What do I say? You know, how do I navigate that? So it's interesting that those triggers, those moments in each one of our families where we do then talk about race and how do we convey it to our children? Because we don't want them to see. We notice differences, but we don't want them to see people or judge them differently because of something so trivial as skin. Unfortunately, that has been the history, not only in this country, but in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I think it's also important. You know, I first and foremost identify myself as a black male, and I don't, you know, the idea of colorblindness to me disenfranchises what I believe to be part of my identity. So I think the idea of being colorblind is a fallacy. The idea of appreciating you for what you are is where I'd like to see people go, because you can't look at me and tell me you don't see a black male. Like, that's just, you're just making that up, because there's nothing else you, I can't look like anything else. But the idea that you then decide to associate all of these negative connotations with me because I'm a black male is where it goes wrong. So I never want you to not recognize who I am. It's an important part of my identity, my experiences. Just don't automatically judge me because I am. Let me introduce myself to you as I let you introduce yourself to me, and then we can decide whether or not we're going to be friends on issues other than race or politics or class or zip code.
Let's take some calls now. Jason's calling from Middletown. Jason, you're on the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, just my comment. My parents, I'm a child of an interracial couple, and you know, growing up in the 70s, my parents tell me even today of stories, the difficulties that they had even back then with people staring at them, staring at me, and, you know, just the difficult times that they had. But, you know, they persevered. And, you know, growing up, I think really the most important thing for interracial couples with children is to remind their children that, you know, they're beautiful, they have the best of both worlds, and that, you know, it's important that they don't have to choose sides, that, you know, it's a hard thing growing up biracial, because sometimes you have friendships that are white, sometimes you have friends that are black, and they might not get along, and you have to try to choose sides. But, you know, when you have some strong parents that are instilling in their children that it's okay to be who they are, then, you know, it really helps. And, it, you know, they persevered for like 47 years now, and, you know, it's couples like them that make the world a better place. It's more beautiful.
Well, thank you so much for your comment, Jason. And Shannon, did you want to respond to what Jason was saying about, you know, strong, supportive parents and the message that parents can give their children?
Sure, absolutely. That I really appreciate the caller's comments. I think that's absolutely correct. And I want to say, you know, I really admire my husband. He is probably the least shy person you've ever met in your life. And I've seen, you know, it's fun to sit back and watch him. I'm pretty extroverted too, but he's just amazing. And I think the kids see him. He's the first one in the room to walk in and greet everybody and to talk to everybody. And I think, you know, when people are uncomfortable, they're going to do the staring, like the caller was talking about. They're going to not know what to say. And Rahsaan never lets that moment happen. And I think that is just so admirable, because he walks into a room and everybody is his friend. It doesn't matter. You know, when I came to the studio today and he was in the lobby talking to several people, I was not surprised to see that. He beat me in for about 5 minutes and he already was holding court. And it was, you know, I just really admire that. And I think that is also helped us be fortunate with not having to really confront a lot of uncomfortable situations because he really stops them before they can even start and helps everybody feel very comfortable. And seeing, having our kids see that, I think, is so important.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about interracial marriages. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Bill's calling from East Haddam. Bill, you're on the show.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yep, go ahead.
I was in an interracial marriage. I'm white. My wife was mixed from Louisiana. She was Creole. In the mid-1970s, we were married. My mother was from Georgia, and she was absolutely opposed to it. My father had traveled and had dated women of other cultures and ethnicities. The reason that I called was, I think that language creates problems. The use of the term race is scientifically a falsehood. There is only one human race. And what do these children call themselves? Do they call themselves white or black or mixed race? Even the term race adds to the confusion. The terms white and black are also kind of artificial constructs. And what I came to conclude was, even though they're cultural concepts, the idea that we reinforce this idea of instead of ethnicity or nationality, we use this term race when there's only one human race. And I often say we all descended from Africans. We're all of African descent. And so I think it's important when you're having the conversation to use the accurate words. So I wanted to get that out there because you keep saying race or mixed race, but the term race itself, is, as far as geneticists, and science has generally been completely, there are not distinct races. There are different variations of one human race.
Well, thank
and
you.
I'd love to hear the comment.
Yeah, thank you for your comment. You know, we had this discussion before the show, too. We'd heard from a listener who says that she's in an interracial marriage, but she prefers to call it interheritage marriage. What do you think about that, Rahsaan?
I think he makes an interesting point. I mean, the idea of classifying people into categories is unfortunately a very human construct. And I think if we didn't have race, it would be eye color or hair color or the size of your nose, the size of your lips. I mean, you know, clearly the idea of racial differentiation in this country comes back to, you know, bringing slaves over from Africa and having to identify people differently. In order to, you know, categorize a better or a lesser group of people. But I think he's right because at the end of the day, you know, you're a construct of your experiences and exposures. And so, if I was a black kid born in Glastonbury to two doctors, my experience would be very different than being a black child born in Harlem to an eventual sitcom writer and a teacher. And I think that, you know, the idea of being black, I think as black people, we're just beginning to recognize that just being black can mean a rainbow of experiences, that not all of us grew up in urban environments, not all of us grew up disenfranchised and poor, and that there are different experiences and that we have to recognize and accept even one another as black people, even when we don't sound or talk or share the same experiences as those that may look like us.
Do you take offense when you hear interracial marriage?
I may going forward. I never really thought of it. You know, obviously the idea of race as a man-made construct, I've in many ways just accepted that term as the term that we use. But I think the last caller really kind of maybe brought me to think about what is a better way to think about different groups of people, again, without minimizing how they may want themselves to be identified, but being conscious of the fact that they may not want to be categorized in a race. For me, it's okay.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You can join the conversation today. We're talking about people who marry outside how they identify or their race. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. When we come back, we're going to hear from another Connecticut couple, and we're going to take your calls and comments. And do you think society's perceptions are changing? Join the conversation. Thank you. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, 58 years, 50 states, one governor's commitment to change. On the next Where We Live, statehood for Puerto Rico. Some say yes, others say no way. We'll consider what lies ahead for the island. Also, President Donald Trump has plans to crack down on sanctuary cities. What does that mean for Connecticut? We'll dig in. Now, today we're talking about interracial marriages, 50 years after a landmark Supreme Court decision, Loving v. Virginia. And we wanted to speak to people in our state who are married to someone outside the race. Joining us now is another Connecticut couple, Norm Garrick and James Hanley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about how you met. I'll start with you, James.
Well, I work at Cine Studio, the movie theater at Trinity College, and we were the founding place for the Connecticut LGBT Film Festival. And in 1988, that was our first festival, and Norman was attending, and that's where we met.
And Norm, what do you remember?
More or less the same thing. I think we do have some different versions of this story when we get to the details.
Mm-hmm. And tell me where you're both originally from.
I'm from Jamaica.
And James?
I was born in England and came to the U.S. to go to school and have been here since.
So when people see you, what do you think they first notice as a couple?
Well, I think they probably notice the chemistry between us, perhaps. That's the thing. We tend to be constantly communicating, I think, that in ways that, you know, indicate that we're, you know, together. And so I think that's the first thing people would notice.
What about you, Nor?
I'm not sure. I think it differs depending on where we are. We have lived in various places and been in various places, and I think it varies whether or not we're in Jamaica or in Switzerland or in the UK or here in the US. So it's really difficult for me to say.
Now, we're pegging the show to the Loving court decision back in 1967. What does that case mean to each of you?
Well, I did know a lot about the history. I mean, it's always been this iconic case, you know, these people that were very important in terms of changing civil rights law, but also were very important in terms of setting a foundation for helping to change the status of gay couples. But seeing the movie was really a fascinating experience, getting to know these very simple people that were really just wanting to live their lives. And what was most fascinating for me of the story is the realization that this was just 50 years ago, that we had this insidious extension of slavery in America where people could be put in prison for being married. It was really shocking. The realization was really shocking to me.
Now, you are from Jamaica. What is the perceptions of you as a couple when you go and visit family?
Well, I think the main issue there is getting over the fact that we are a gay couple. Mm-hmm. But I think we have dealt with those issues. We have been together for 28 years, so we have dealt with it on the basis of our families. What is fascinating is having the formal recognition of marriage and how that changes our relationship to the Jamaican state. For example, Jamaica has this reputation for being very homophobic, but when we land in Kingston and we present ourselves as a married couple, then the Jamaican state adjusts and treats it as a normal state. And it's really fascinating to see how they have adjusted.
And James, what about you? What does a Loving decision mean for you?
Well, I think for me, I had a similar reaction to the film that it was sort of like a wake-up call, education kind of thing of the details behind it. But I think one of the connections, Norman used the word slavery as part of that, and the power of slavery and the violence that maintained that system. The thing that it reminded me of is that all of these things that are expressed through laws in some places that are really limiting people, and it's about power and control, is the implication of violence. It's not even an implication. It's a direct violence to people's way of life and to their persons. And that the message is that if you don't do what you're told, you're going to suffer and physical violence will follow. And I think that that film, it's a curious paradox to me. It's a very quiet film, but also very powerful in what it says, that not so long ago, these laws were in place, and they used words that were demeaning and controlling. These words like miscegenation, you know, miss something, mm-hmm. that somehow there's something wrong here. And that these are all about power and control, which, of course, we're getting a new lesson about right now.
When we're talking about the gay community, how big of a deal is race today?
Huh. Well, it's very interesting. And the gay community has gone through, I think, a lot of good changes in recent years, a lot of advances of sort of awareness. But I think that the gay community had a lot of problems with discrimination generally for many, many years, during the times when all of the sort of coming out and the celebration of gay culture was mainstream, if you like, and being celebrated widely. It wasn't dealing with racism. And for instance, in Hartford, you could go to a gay bar where they'd be counting the number of dark-skinned people coming in, and they'd decide when they had too many, and then they'd start carding people and saying, well, you know, you can't come in for some reason. And I think that that was something very insidious that was hard to fight. But I think that in many ways that battle was joined, and I think it's better than it was. But these things are very subtle underlying things that suddenly pop out in ways that control people's lives, that at the time you figure, what can you do? You know, you've just been refused entry to a place because you've been perceived to be other, mm-hmm. and the other is being expressed as a form of power.
And Norm?
I think the gay community is a reflection of the more mainstream community, and a lot of the issues of racism, of discrimination. But even beyond that is issues of ageism and things like that. It reflects mainstream attitudes. But I think at the same time, I think the gay community is a better place in some ways. You can find your niche where you don't have to be exposed to some of the worst element of the racial attitudes in America.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking with interracial couples living in Connecticut, pegged to the 50 years since the landmark Supreme Court decision, Loving v. Virginia. I want to take some calls now. Anne's calling from Stamford. Anne, you're on the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was lucky enough to meet my husband, who's Chinese, in my freshman year in 77. And we got married 5 years later and been together for 40 years now, about. So the best thing for us was actually the ripple effect it had in our families, because all of his siblings either married interracially, you know, to whites like me, and or dated them. And one very, very unhappy cousin divorced her family-approved Chinese husband and married her high school sweetheart, and who was white, and very happy ever since. So I think the ripple effect is powerful. And but what's interesting is twice in the last year, people have asked me, how did you get your last name? Like, I just held up my hand and said, it's been 40 years. Where have you been? And their faces just kind of go a little shocky. It's like, I don't know. So, but 99% of the time, no reactions, nothing negative. It's been a great life.
Well, we're glad to hear that, and it speaks to what we were saying. Even though the civil rights era, just 50 years ago, we think about each generation removed from it, and how we are becoming a more blended society, and that can be a good thing. I want to take another call, Mason from Old Saybrook. Mason, you're on the show.
Well, good morning. I love this show. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
I think the callers also have been extraordinary. I want to know how your guests feel about the current political situation. We've had our first biracial president and our first black family in the White House, who were dignified and a source of pride for our country. They've been replaced by an intolerant, angry guy. Is this just something that? How do you? Are we going to regress? I think the Supreme Court is safe because I don't think the balance of the court will change during the next 4 years, unless Justice Ginsburg would happen to pass away. But how do you feel about the fact that there was an angry white male backlash to the presidency of the historic presidency of Barack Obama?
Thank you for that question. We have 4 minutes, so we may not have time for everyone to answer that. But I'll start with Shannon. We'll try to get everyone in. Shannon?
Sure. I'm terrified, and not necessarily for the actual president, but for the big permission slip it has seemed to give to the general public to be able to say what wasn't acceptable and what we were trying so hard to move beyond and grow as a society is now, I think, really backstepping. And it scares me that it's suddenly much more acceptable to be really open about being prejudiced and just in violence, to use what James was saying before. I think, you know, that's the stuff that really scares me. And I know Rasan and I kind of see things differently. He tends to try and calm me down a little bit because I am really, I'm really disappointed in where we've gone as a society and in so much of the actions that we've seen since the election that have just really started like wildfire. And it does worry me that it's just going to keep having more fuel and more fuel on it. So luckily my husband's very good at calming me down and helping me get recentered, but it is scary times, I think.
And again, well, we're talking about civil rights today, right? What we've seen in our country, the struggles and the fight for equality. James, did you want to chime in about what you see the future hold? We just have a couple of minutes.
Well, I just see, I like the word resistance, and I think resist at every turn. And I think to a certain extent your expectations count. Because if you somehow transmit the idea that you're under threat and you're going to fold in the face of that threat, then I think that people will feel empowered to use discrimination and violence and threats of all kinds. And so I think that it's very important that people who have a sense of themselves and realize that, like in, for instance, your own personal relationship, that's your personal relationship, that's your life. It's nobody else's business to tell you about it. And in every expression of this vulgarian violence that we're engulfed in now, it has to be resisted.
Rasan.
Yeah, just quickly, I think that for me as a black male, I think the election of Trump is really just a reflection of who we really are as a country. And I think that we fell into a false sense of security with the election of Obama. I mean, you know, the Trayvon Martins, the gardeners in New York, the gentleman in South Carolina getting shot in the back by police officers. I mean, those are all things that always existed. I think that the election of Trump for many white people is the first time they get to feel disenfranchised in their own country, which is what many minorities and immigrants have felt since day one.
And Norm.
Yes, I agree. I think this nonsense about post-racial society that we got with the election of Obama, I think all of this has put light to that. But it's also hopeful. I think back to Ronald Reagan and during the period when AIDS was rampant and his reaction to that. And what came out of that was a backlash that changed the culture and, in fact, probably led to gay marriage. And also, these kinds of changes can result in good backlash if we are willing to resist.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests for talking very candidly about their lives and about race in this country. It can be a taboo subject, but we should keep talking about it, and we will. Thank you so much to Shannon, Rasan, James, and Norm.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.